You're listening to the Law and Business Podcast, hosted by Anthony Verna. We tackle the difficult questions where business and the law intersect to help you run a smarter business and avoid costly mistakes. Brought to you by Verna Law PC, a full-service law firm focusing on patents, trademarks, copyrights, domain names, and advertising law. For more information, call 914-908-6757 or send an email to anthony@vernalaw.com for more information.
Welcome to the Law and Business Podcast. I am here with Raj Goyal from BrainLink International. How are you doing, Raj?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Anthony?
I am well, thank you. Raj, why don't you tell everybody who's listening about BrainLink?
BrainLink is a New York City-based IT and cybersecurity consulting firm. We work with hedge funds, construction firms, and fast-growing businesses that are operationally mature.
And I want to get into this topic of operationally mature businesses. You and I were having dinner, and we talked about it for a little bit, and it was a fascinating topic to me about how a business owner thinks about his or her business. And there is a difference between that operational maturity and not having that operational maturity. So why don't you give me your general thoughts on the topic?
So first, starters, this is not my revelation general thought. There's a whole body of business literature that talks about OML's operational maturity levels. And essentially, there are five stages in every business's life cycle, at least the ones that don't go bankrupt or end. Initially, it starts out with an entrepreneur having a gut feel for the business, you know, whether it's a one-person law firm or a one-person IT firm or a freelance graphic artist, you're going by gut feel. Then over time, you get some contractors, employees, you grow in size, and the next level up is a bit of standardization, and then you pick your favorite brand of Macs or Windows and software, and you've got three or four people. Now, all of you have to have some sort of standards. And that's where a lot of businesses end up, at least small ones. Stage three is a formal standardization of processes, SOPs, how you do everything by checklist and process, and there are no more cowboys and cowgirls left, and people get disciplined or sanctioned, including the owner, for breaking the rules or going off script, unless absolutely necessary. By stage four, now you're actually doing things like forecasting budgets, forecasting revenue, and turning into, quote-unquote, a real business. And level five is what companies like IBM and Microsoft and KPMG and GM are, where their development cycles and their forecasting and their future planning is measured in years or decades. They have lots of processes. They have lots of regulations. They have a system for doing things. And ultimately, that is what transforms a one-man, one-woman business or a hobby with a paycheck into a real company, is when it scales beyond one person or the initial founder, and it survives on its own as an ongoing business entity.
So why don't you evaluate yourself here, and where is BrainLink on that particular scale? And when did you realize where you were on that scale, and how did you move it up?
Several great questions. So right now we are in the 2.5, 2.7 rating on a scale of 1 to 5, or 0
okay.
to 5. I only realized where we were recently when I was at a conference for business owners where we talked about OML levels and this whole grid of how you rate yourself, and I went through an assessment. But the need to improve operational maturity didn't start recently. It is something that bit us hard about 5 years ago. We were working with a client, a very well-run construction firm, and every review meeting I had with the client, CTO, or owner was a humiliating, painful experience.
How so?
I would go, you know, hey, how are things? How did we do? I was expecting you guys are okay. They're doing a great job, or you guys are, your team is really nice. What I got instead were, hey, your guy came in, set up two laptops, and the signature is missing on one of them. Or, you know, your guy was here last week, and my printers don't work. And don't you guys have a process? Don't you guys have a checklist? And my initial thought was, dude, that's how IT works. That's been the SOP for our company. for over 20 years, and that's just the way our industry behaves. And it was a painful meeting to be in, and I nearly considered severing that relationship because I couldn't find a way to make this client happy. And after blowing my top and losing my cool and, you know, just getting really, really angry, I spoke to a few friends, including ones who are not in the industry, who are not in the IT field. And surprisingly, all my IT friends are like, yeah, you know, the client's a fill in the blank, you got to just fire him. All my non-IT friends said, yeah, the guy's got a point. I really hate my IT guy. I really hate my IT girl. You know, yeah, I don't like calling IT because they always suck. And that is a damning indictment of my industry and how we run things. And that led to an epiphany of, well, it didn't lead to an epiphany. It just led to a frustration. And then I was reading The Economist, December 2013 issue, if I recall, and they had a great sidebar on the great hotels of the world. I love traveling. I love going to great hotels. It's been a privilege of mine to stay at amazing properties. And in this sidebar, you know, basically third of a page in The Economist, mm-hmm. they had an interview with Bill Marriott Jr., and he said, and the full quote they had is, he said, I am not kidding when I say that the secret to our fortune, you know, parentheses, multi-billion dollar fortune,
right,
is based on simple things like our 88 steps on how to clean a room manual.
Wait, go on. 88 steps to clean a room.
Yes.
I think for the average business owner, I think for the average listener to this podcast, they're going to hear that and kind of freak out as to what that...
As they should. As they rightly should. My first reaction was, are you kidding me? But then a couple of things clicked in my head. You know, we had some clients in the hospitality industry. Some owned McDonald's franchises, some owned Hilton, and one of them was changing the brand from Hilton to Marriott, and I got talking to him. I said, you know, what's the difference? I always assumed that the logo on the stationery and the logo on the carpet was just that, just the logo, no real difference.
Well, now I can tell you that yeah. I know that that's not the case, because when you franchise, you are licensing a business model.
I didn't know that then. And so I ended up speaking to this business owner over several drinks, and he said, yeah, you know, I have to put all my people through all this training, and it's going to be expensive, but it's required to change the flag. I'm like, really? There's really that big a difference between how Hilton and Marriott make beds or vacuum the floors or pour coffee? He goes, yeah, everything from the color of our carpets and the color of in our walls to how our people greet our guests is in the manual.
Mm-hmm.
And my first reaction was, are you bloody kidding me? That's just ridiculous. But the more I thought about it, it made sense that every great business, McDonald's, Starbucks, every franchise, every business out there that has survived more than 10, 15 years and beyond the founder, all they're really selling you are their SOPs. When you become a McDonald's franchise, you go through Burger U. When you become a Burger King franchise, you go through Burger King University. And what you're learning is their process and their practices. And that got me thinking, we should start documenting our things. And I tried, and I went to my team and said, hey, I have an epiphany, a lightning bolt from the heavens. We're going to write SOPs. And my entire team looked at me as if I'd spouted a third head and a horn and essentially gave me the proverbial and the physical middle finger. They said,
well,
yeah.
Well, look.
And
my...
they looked at it.
I mean, look, my first law firm was just as chaotic. It was a small firm. The owner of the firm was kicked out of the big firm. I will say that. I was told he left. No, he was kicked out. But he brought his team with him. And I thought that that was going to have that particular standard. You know, well, the team is there, so this must be good. But man, it was crazy. There wasn't a standard of handling clients, taking phone calls. There would be times when the secretary would, you know, page me in, and I'm a first year associate, and she'd be like, look, we have an irate client and Scott's on the phone, and like, Scott was always on the phone, and how do you deal with that particular issue? And Scott would like every third day it felt like, make yet another ironclad written in stone rule, and then we would all have to follow it, and 3 seconds after he said it, he totally forgot what he said. So I we had two versions of scheduling software. One actually set up for an intellectual property law firm, but we only had two licenses on it, one for him and one for a paralegal, and we had to go make our own schedule in a different piece of software after that. Like, so I understand why when you try to put that together, now there's a bit of latency in the rest of your team.
It's not just latency. They were right in that, okay, how is this not one of other Roger's crazy schemes that'll, harebrained schemes that'll blow up and die in 30 minutes, you know, or 30 seconds. I think as founders and business owners, we sometimes have the goldfish mentality. I know I certainly do. Ooh, shiny object. And so this idea landed with my team as a giant thud. The blunders of the likes of which we haven't seen until recent elections. And I'm not going to, that's all I'm going to say about that. So I said, okay, fine. You know, fine. I was not as polite as I thought, as I could have been, but I was traveling a lot. So I ended up writing a couple of SOPs for my marketing admin. Basically, how do we send out our weekly emails? How do we create a monthly newsletter? The 5 or 10 things I needed her to do, cause I was too busy flying and going to conference to deal with.
Okay.
And I figured worst case scenario, she gets it 80% accurate. Even 50% is better than my zero, because I'm not going to get it done. And anything is better than nothing. And I wrote them to her literally as I was sitting in an airport terminal about to catch my flight. And if I got delayed, what else can I do? Gee, write some documentation, because either that or watch CNN in the airports. I wrote that up, sent it to her, went off of my conference. And I came back 2 weeks later after two different conferences, and my jaw hit the floor. She had sent the emails out weekly on time by 11 a.m. on Tuesdays, 2 weeks in a row. One had a typo, which, of course, all my friends made fun of.
Right.
The other one was correct. But other than that, she had done a better job of getting stuff out on time than I had. I said, great, let's work on the monthly newsletter. And she actually did a much better job than I did of organizing things, because I, as the creator and the owner, can give myself free passes to you. That's not important. She, as the employee and not the owner, was much more diligent about staying within the lines and following the rules. And about a month later, I said, hey, guys, you know, my marketing admin is doing all this great marketing work through SOPs. How about we work on the tech stuff, our real bread and butter? And the tech team said, yeah, that works for marketing. It'll never work in IT. It doesn't work in IT operations. It's too important. We're too smart. Marketing is dumb. Okay, fine. And then since I was traveling quite a bit, I hired an intern to take some of my technical tasks, which I was responsible for. And I told him, like, here's what I'm going to do. Here's a problem that showed up on this server. I'm going to show you how I fix it. Your job is to watch, take notes, and write the SOP.
Okay.
And that's how I trained my intern, or didn't train him, but it's how I showed my intern how to document my work. He wasn't technically qualified to do the work, and that was not his job. I was too busy and too expensive to sit there and spend 8 hours fighting with Word to create documentation. So the happy trick I figured out is, hey, you got a college kid, you pay him 10, 15, 20 bucks an hour, depending on your time and what the prevailing rules are. We paid our interns. I said, great. I'm going to launch GoToMeeting. I'm going to record what I'm doing. You're going to sit next to me. He was literally sitting right next to me. I used GoToMeeting to record what I was doing on screen. I talked him through exactly what I was doing and why I was doing it. I said, great. Okay. Now go draft some SOPs. And the first couple were terrible.
I was going to say, I can't imagine that the procedures themselves matched what you were looking for.
The first couple were terrible. Atrociously bad, but he did get the formatting right, and in a couple of cases he caught details that I had glossed over, because as a neophyte he brought that amazing worldview of, I don't know what that means, let me flag it. And what I've learned since then, and this is something we've used with a number of business owners, key executives, is you know what you're doing in your business. You built it. You know how to do this podcast. You know how to onboard a new client. You know how to file paperwork. You know how to do things. When you're training somebody else, budget time for them to make mistakes, budget time for them to learn the basics, and then follow the 80-20 rule. The Pareto principle applies. If they get 80% of the topic right, it's worth anything and everything you'll pay them, because if they can spend 8 hours to save me 1 hour of my time, it's worth it. There are times when I've paid somebody to spend 40 hours to save me 1 hour of my life.
So what other ways has your businesses improved as your, you know, as your OMLs have improved?
So the big thing about OMLs, as you improve your operational maturity level, the kind of clientele you attract and you do business with changes. 10 years ago, if you had a pulse on a keyboard, we were chasing you for business. 6 years ago, we were looking for well-established companies, but still no real market definition. Today, we only take operationally mature clients. What does that mean? In our construction space, we don't work with firms that are less than 50 years old. Why? I'm too old to deal with startups. I love startups dearly. They bring great technology and great products into the world, but they're operationally chaotic. They have no real management, and they're learning on the fly. And that's great for other firms to take on. We take operationally mature firms where they have proper management, where they have a chain of command, where they have systems and processes, and where they need help in improving that or getting a better return on their investments. And on the financial side, our hedge fund and private equity clients are firms 10, 15, 20 years old, precisely because we like firms that know what they're doing, that are going to be around for a while. Yeah, a market crash could take out half our client base. That's reality. So could other events. But as a betting man, I would say clients have been around for 50, 60 years. Don't die in the next bubble. Firms that have been investing for 15, 20 years, don't die in the next Bitcoin crash.
Agreed.
And those kind of clients tend to value firms that follow processes and procedures. And as a result, our revenues have grown wonderfully. Our profitability is the best it's ever been. And it gives us the ability to hire more expensive staff, work with more expensive vendors, and improve our capabilities. The more we improve our operations and our processes, the better the clientele we're attracting and the better the clientele we're dealing with. Because people recognize cowboys from a safe pair of hands. And there's another wonderful quote from Paul Dippel. He's a world-leading expert on OML for IT companies. And he's just studied OML for the last 30-plus years. He's worked with a lot of large firms. And he said, high operationally mature companies, OML 4 and higher, they only go after the top 20% of the market, where business owners have a need and a budget and a process for getting things done, and you leave the 80% of the market to your competition to fight over. Why do large companies work with IBM and KPMG and Ernst & Young and those guys? Because large firms are high operationally mature. They only want to work with other high OML firms. And that makes so much more sense. The more we improve our processes, the more we're attracted to firms with good processes, and more allergic I am and we are to chaotic cowboys and cowgirls.
So how does a business start thinking about their OMLs and improving? And where would one start for more information on improving their OMLs?
So first is just Google, you know, just search for OML or operational maturity levels. And depending on the industry, every industry has metrics from experts in the field on what separates an OML 1 law firm from an OML 5 law firm, for example, or an OML 1 manufacturing company from an OML 5. You know, there's ISO standards on manufacturing, quality control, things like that. And for bringing process into the business, there are three good books I recommend business owners read. Yeah, I know we all get so many book recommendations, but these are effectively our Bibles at BrainLink. First is Get Things Done. It's an amazing book on how to delegate and delegate effectively. Next is The 4-Hour Workweek. Lousy title, but a great book, a master's level discourse.
I think a lot of people think, oh, well, that means I can only work 4 hours a week once I read that book. And that's not really quite true.
That's not quite true, but once you read that book and you apply at least some of the tactics and principles, you'll be amazed at how much more of your life you can delegate to third parties, whether it's your travel agent, whether it is your concierge app or other firms. Nice thing about living in the modern economy is things you consider grunt work and things you don't want to do, the other people who just are delighted to do that. You know, a couple of good examples. I do a lot of presentations, and I battle PowerPoint every single time, and I'm not a designer. And I've wasted so much of my life trying to get the PowerPoint to look right or the graphics to look right. Instead of that, go to a site like Fiverr.com or a freelancer, tell them what I want or what I want done, give them some time, give them a budget to work with, and I come back with great results. You know, one trick I've learned in that arena is, so I have a PowerPoint deck that I want to turn into a really nice Prezi animated presentation.
Oh, sure. I've seen Prezi animations. They're very impressive.
They're impressive. I don't have the time to figure out how to make them work, and I don't care to. So I go, here's my PowerPoint deck. Here's what I'm looking for. Here's what I'm not looking for. I don't want a lot of flashing things. I don't want a lot of color transitions. I want something that's more like the Game of Thrones opening sequence and less like an acid flashback from the 70s. And I will hire 2, 3, or 4 contractors off of Fiverr or Freelancer, let them go crazy with it, and then whoever's stuff I like or I like best, I'll go, great. I like this and this from what you did. I like this from these other people I paid for. Can you combine these 3 or 4, and then I get what I want? And that would not have been possible had I not read and mastered the 4-hour work week, because it really taught me how to break down what I want into tiny bite-sized instructions other people can follow or other people can comprehend. Mistake I made, and I think a lot of people make early on when they go to delegation, is they try to dump 5,000 item checklists on somebody else, when in reality, when you're delegating, at least when you're starting out, and you don't know the person, they don't know you, giving them bite-sized individual tasks is much more intelligent and saves a lot more sanity. And the third book I recommend, and it's a book I live by, is Checklist Manifesto. The goal of anything you're doing, and the goal of anything I'm doing, is first I figure out how to do it. Actually, first I figure, do I need to do it? If I don't need to do it, delegate it to somebody else. And that takes care of 80% of things that, quote unquote, I need to get done. The remaining 20% of things that only I can do, okay, first I figure out how to do it. For example, right before this call, our CRM system upgraded to a new version, and they have a fantastic sales funnel module that I haven't learned. I had not learned before. So on Monday, I went to a class with a trainer and learned how to use sales module. And in the hour before this interview, I actually went through the sales module training that I took on Monday, and I started creating the SOP on how to put a new lead into the new version of the CRM, how to do forecasting, and then how to look at our sales funnel, something we've never done before as a company, and something I would not have done even 3 months ago. But since I'm building out a sales team for 2018, I'm going to be hiring salespeople, I can't have them fly by the seat of their pants.
No, not at all, not when it comes to sales.
And so I've got the SOP drafted. My VP of operations and my CFO are looking at it. They probably won't use it more than once, but they will go through at least once to find any bugs or defects. And as I use that SOP more and more to put in all my sales opportunities and my sales funnel, and then I go to my team and go, okay, who can we consider a lead or a prospect or in qualified, engage, etc. Now that the SOP is done, that's one less thing I have to do, and one more thing I can go to somebody else on my team and say, here, follow this process, do it. Are they going to get it right the first time? Absolutely not. The first 2 or 3 times, people get things wrong in wonderfully annoying ways. You know, they get things wrong in ways I can't comprehend or predict, was the old line. I build foolproof documentation. The universe builds better fools. So we have learned in our own processing and our budgeting that if I'm going to ask them to do something the first time around, give them extra time. Because it's a new platform, it's a new system, it's a new way of doing things. And after the second, third, fourth try, they do a better job than I would myself.
Raj, I can't thank you enough for taking the time. I don't want to take much more of your time because you are busy and we're recording this in the middle of the day. And so thank you so much for coming. Once again, tell people how they could find you if they want to ping you on IT or any other question.
Raj Goel, G-O-E-L. You can go to brainlink.com, B-R-A-I-N-L-I-N-K.com. If you want to learn more about SOPs and process, I have a blog site called SOPculture.com. S-O-P-C-U-L-T-U-R-E. Service marked by your friendly Mr. Anthony Verna, attorney at law. So I blog there about how to improve operations and processes and how to do better onboarding of clients and all that jazz. Otherwise, just Google me. There's 20 million Raj Goels in the world, and Google still thinks I'm number one.
Hey, I do pretty well under Anthony Verna, so it's pretty helpful when you're top in your own name, I should say.
Exactly.
And the person who invented instant replay is an Anthony Verna, so I'm ranking over his family. So, yeah.
Can we go back to videotape and confirm that, please?
Raj, thank you so much for coming, and let's do this again at a later date.
Absolutely, Anthony. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been the Law and Business Podcast. Visit vernalaw.com for more episodes. To contact Verna Law PC, send an email to anthony@vernalaw.com or call 914-